It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, Pittsburgh Regional Transit unveiled updated plans for the Bus Rapid Transit Project, which will use exclusive lanes to provide service between downtown Pittsburgh and Oakland, inbound on Fifth Avenue, outbound on Forbes. It also comes with an increased cost, $291 million. Catherine Kellerman is the CEO of PRT. Welcome back to the Confluence, Catherine.
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
The cost estimate for the Bus Rapid Transit Project is up about $61 million. What's behind that increase?
There is a lot that factors into this. First, I want to say we're all dealing with inflation, especially on construction projects. We also are absorbing a little bit of liability cost. When you open the pavement in a town like Pittsburgh, there is an awful lot underneath there that could have shifted or eroded or moved over time. So our friends at the Federal Transit Administration wanted to up what we were putting in for some contingencies and for utility right-of-way relocation. And again, just with our state of infrastructure, it ends up being expensive. Each year that we delay going forward would end up costing us more. So we want to make sure that we can get this project up and running. Even with pandemic traffic, it's still crazy getting through Oakland. And we've made this commitment to our communities that we will not just improve that bus trip, but we'll use what we can to improve the corridor for everybody traveling through it. So let's go ahead and get it done before inflation or anything else makes it more expensive.
You mentioned the contingencies. There have also been aspects of the project I understand have been delayed or put off, such as stations outside of the project's area, correct?
Right. The footprint of everything covered in this original project included 71 stations. Again, our friends at the Federal Transit Administration felt that that was a really big footprint for us to work on at one time. When we look at other cities or areas that have put in projects like this, they've put it into smaller phases, which are more manageable and easier to deliver all each phase coming up concurrently rather than all at one time. So in consultation with the FTA, we made the decision to move the outlying stations for future improvements. The service coming by will be no different, but we will be coming back in a later project, ideally using some of this great IIJA infrastructure money to put in the stations which we have promised to our communities.
At this point, what aspects of the overall project are locked in that the public can expect from this investment?
Well, definitely, you will see the downtown loop breaking ground next year. And that's all that has usually been, always historically, I would say, where we have the greatest interface on so many buses going through town, trying to turn, getting stuck in traffic. So being able to make those routing changes and the running time changes in downtown will be super helpful for the rest of these routes. Folks will also see the promised improvements in Uptown and Oakland, and those will include the standalone bike lane. They will include the improved stations throughout Oakland and Uptown, where folks will be able to wait out of the elements, but also the stations are designed to accommodate a lot of through traffic, so folks can get off and get on their vehicles pretty quickly, and also the off-board fare payment, so folks are tapping their fare before they get on.
The phases that are delayed, are there concerns that delay turns into never?
I think anyone who hears a project has been delayed is always going to say, oh my goodness, and especially in a corridor like this, where, I mean, how long has Pittsburgh been talking about this corridor? 10 years, 12 years? I think people will always be worried it won't come, but we are making the commitment, and you will see it in future capital budgets, that we will be pursuing this. And this also is part and parcel of this rebrand of going to Pittsburgh Regional Transit, is it will take time to hit every single stop to make these improvements, but not just the folks in our BRT corridor. Everyone deserves a stop with a 5x8 concrete pad or somewhere where which is level to weight or a curb cut. So if you're using a stroller or a grocery cart or a mobility device, you can get to the bus easily, that you have signage that lets you know when that vehicle is coming at a high volume stop. Or at a minimum, there's a QR code that you can use to see where your bus is and you see what the bus number is that's planned for your route so you know you're at the right stop.
PRT held a public meeting last week and plans another Thursday of this week. What are you hearing from the community? Are they still interested? Because, as you said, things have been delayed.
We are definitely hearing that folks are still interested. They are They are very focused on the details of what we are bringing forward in these phases to make sure that we are making good on our previous commitments. And making this a smooth traveling corridor is the key for a lot of our other services to being reliable. Because if you get stuck in Oakland and Uptown, you can't get back on schedule in many cases.
Were you, I don't know, frustrated when, because the loop, the downtown to Oakland loop, but there were also branches of the BRT, when it was suggested or advised by the feds that, you know, you delay things, was that frustrating to you? And do you think it's frustrating to the public?
Well, Kevin, you know me, so I think it's safe to say that frustration is a gentle term for my reaction. By design, my background is in planning and scheduling, which is a very immediate way to impact our neighborhoods, you know, making these changes on our routes and our service very quickly, also helping out our operators with the best possible work assignment. And so I am just wired to look for what are those kind of improvements. It is very good to have the balance of the longer term folks saying, here's our investment, here's how this works for us going forward. So while it was deeply frustrating to see the cost change so much and have to spend a lot of additional time on wrangling into what was a solution that was, you know, cost effective, maybe not as quickly as I wanted to go, but definitely cost effective, I'm glad that we had the opportunity to get a little more input. I am a broken record, but the world we had March 13th, 2020 doesn't exist anymore. And while when I came on board, we did an awful lot in 18 and 19 on the BRT, this has really given us an opportunity to hear post-COVID, what is it folks want? I mean, and what we want and everything in our lives has changed. That's no different for transit patrons. The big slug of folks riding in rush hour has moved. We're seeing a lot more lifestyle trips. We're seeing a lot more of folks riding in evenings or coming back on weekends, making up for the trips that we didn't have in rush hour. And so honestly, this delay, as much as it's frustrating, has given us an opportunity to make sure that this project is relevant in a post-COVID Pittsburgh. I don't want to say that I appreciate that because I hate the delay, but I honestly do appreciate the chance to make sure we're still relevant in this project. It's a lot of money. We need to be doing this the right way.
Catherine, aside from the Bus Rapid Transit Project, where does things stand now in terms of ridership for the system compared to pre-pandemic levels?
So pre-pandemic, depending on where you are, your local bus might be at 40%, your local bus might be at 80%. Some of the routes that we invested in during the pandemic for frequency and spacing actually are exceeding their pre-pandemic ridership. But on the whole, our bus is about 60%, a little over 60% of where we were in 2019. In 2019 going into 2020, we were growing month over month. We'd seen some really good ridership gains. So the ridership definitely has changed, but we're still an engine for the county.
A Post-Gazette analysis of ridership data as of June 30th shows the weekday average ridership for the bus is about 88,000, still down from pre-pandemic levels. Has ridership leveled off, total ridership leveled off, not capacity of buses? And what are your projections? Will you get back at some point to those overall total number of riders?
So we are not leveled off. We continue to see growth. And here are things in transit. Summer is a soft season, regardless of where you are in the U.S., because people go on vacation or school is out. We have six universities now, six schools on our UPass program, for instance, to participate in a program where students just tap their ID or their phone and the university pays for that. That is a generator of ridership. These schools are back fully. And we're adding new schools, so we expect to see growth in that. We have overhauled our fare structure to make it easier for folks to ride, a little more flexible. I would like to say that whatever's going to happen with folks' remote work will be stabilized within the next year. I would have said that last year, though, so don't hold me to it. But we would plan that any company that's going to come back will do that within the next year, and any company that's going to stay remote will do so. So that should lock down a little bit more that traditional travel market. But a point I will always make is in 2007 and the 2010-2011 window, Port Authority removed a lot of service. And so now as PRT, we have neighborhoods where people will tell us, I walk 2 miles to get to the bus stop because you took my route away in 2007. And when are you bringing it back? So critical for us is going to be a route overhaul coming in with some consulting help to look at where are people actually traveling now and where do they want to go. Just because you're on a bus route doesn't mean you want to go to that giant eagle. It means that's the closest one you want to get to. So a big part of us being successful going forward is going to be within the next year or so doing a route review, which will lead to a realignment. So it's easier, faster, more attractive, and remains a top mode for folks to get around in Pittsburgh. We will not look the way we did in 2020. That's all I can guarantee. The world is fundamentally different, and we have an opportunity to continue to be flexible and retool to meet that new world.
Catherine, for people who rely on the bus, there are sometimes buses that either never show up or are quite late, maybe get rerouted around the stop. In other cities, the transit app, Google Maps, or through some other means, they're notified of the disruption in service. For PRT, can you explain what disruption management system there is? And is it deployed? Is it not? How long have you had this system?
We do have the tech capability, and we are working out the last internal kinks on who pulls a trigger of what level of notification. So not to get too much into sausage making for this, but when our operations group, for instance, is notified that someone calls in that there's a water main break or a bus is running late or a train couldn't make it out of the yard, our final step is to make sure that whoever gets that notification, we have a very clean process set up to plug it into disruption management. So you know what's going on. And in fact, this week I have my final meeting with my top level folks of how are we getting this organized? I don't have a rollout, but absolutely by the end of the year, folks will have that. That will be the ability to sign up for alerts. Clearly the challenge is always, what do you do for somebody who doesn't have a smartphone, right? Pre-pandemic, 3% of our folks said they didn't have a smartphone, but we're very close to having that disruption management system pushed out.
Catherine Kellerman is CEO of Pittsburgh Regional Transit. Catherine, thanks as always.
Thank you, Kevin. Always a pleasure.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. David McCullough, a Pittsburgh native whose work as an author and historian garnered him 2 Pulitzer Prizes and 2 National Book Awards, died Sunday at age 89. He was also honored with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. His writings included biographies of John Adams and Harry Truman, as well as the building of the Panama Canal and the Brooklyn Bridge and the Johnstown Flood. In a 2016 conversation on WESA, he talked about his love of writing about his hometown area.
Well, I think there's no one spot on the map of this continent, this country, that I feel is so rich with the history of our country. It's got everything. It's where the French and Indian War began. It's where the opening of the West began. It's where industrial America got going. It's also where industrial America of the time that I was a child has virtually disappeared. But the city made a comeback, got up after it had been knocked down. This is an exciting place to be now, but it always was. And it's a story town. That's one of the reasons I love it. River towns are always story towns. And here we got 3 rivers, not just one.
Andy Masick is president and CEO of the Heinz History Center. He joins us now for this remembrance. Andy, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for asking me to talk about David McCullough, a friend and a mentor.
Andy, David McCullough called Pittsburgh a great story town. Is there any better resource for an author, an historian, than a great story town?
David was always focused on the people, the stories of people. He knew that that's what made for good history. And so growing up here in Pittsburgh, his father regaled him with the stories of the characters of Pittsburgh, this river town with all of its eccentricities and wonderful, rich history. David would tell me the story around the dinner table with his 3 brothers. His father would be telling a story, and then David would burst the gravy dam in his mashed potatoes and flood the peas below and shout, "The Johnstown Flood!" And that's the way it was for David growing up here. And so it seems almost inevitable that he would continue as an historian telling those stories of his hometown and the country.
You mentioned the Johnstown Flood. He had said that He wanted to know more about it, couldn't find the book, so he decided to write the book that he was interested in. So we heard what Pittsburgh meant to him, but what has David McCullough meant to Pittsburgh, sharing our region's history to the nation and the world?
As America's favorite historian, David became Pittsburgh's best ambassador. Wherever he went around the world, he always had a Pittsburgh story to tell. And in every book that he wrote, you'll find some sort of Pittsburgh connection.
Mm-hmm. I want to listen to a clip now of David talking about the region, talking about that connection of Pittsburgh to the nation and its impact on the nation.
It's easy to talk about the innovation in Silicon Valley, for example. It's been going on here for a couple of hundred years, and we need to know more about it.
So, Andy, how did David McCullough champion the impact of Pittsburgh and its innovations on the rest of the world that might be a little bit newcomers, if you would, to innovation, whereas Pittsburgh been around for hundreds of years developing innovations?
David saw the innovation that emerged from his hometown, and he found ways to incorporate it into his storytelling, whether it was the story of the path between the seas, the building of the Panama Canal, or whether it was the Great Bridge, the Brooklyn Bridge that was built by a Pittsburgh engineer, John Roebling, or whether it was the Wright brothers, who had to come to Pittsburgh to find an aluminum engine block to get their Wright Flyer off the ground at Kitty Hawk. He knew that innovation was something that emerged from this rough and tumble river city that was the gateway to the West. And when it was time to build a history museum here in Western Pennsylvania, he was the champion for the Heinz History Center, which features innovation.
Mm-hmm. We have just about a minute left, Andy. The Heinz History Center celebrates our region's history. Any plans on the History Center celebrating its greatest historian?
David McCullough is part of the History Center's DNA. It wouldn't be here without him. And I think where you'll see David McCullough in the History Center is in the storytelling that we do. It's the stories of people. It's the stories of innovation. David and his ideas are infused throughout the museum.
And very briefly, historian, best-selling author, Pulitzer Prize winner, Pittsburgher, briefly, how do you describe David McCullough?
David McCullough is America's most beloved historian. For me, he was a mentor and a friend, and I'll miss him.
Andy Masick, President and CEO of the Heinz History Center, thanks so much for your memories of David McCullough.
Thank you for having me.
I had the privilege of interviewing David McCullough several times, including a conversation in 1992 about his just-published book, Truman, which would garner him his first Pulitzer Prize.
I'm a narrative historian. I believe in the narrative form as both a way to hold the reader, to keep the attention of the audience, so to speak, but I also believe in the narrative form as being intellectually the most honest approach, because always you have to keep in mind at every step along the way, what didn't they know? Mm-hmm. To look at it from the mountaintop, so to speak, as many historians do, and to take the grand view, is to have a huge advantage of hindsight, which they never had, which we don't have right now. So to fault a figure in public life or to condemn a whole generation because they failed to know what we know is really, to me, dishonest and unfair. So that I try to always move the story with the time and to see the sort of the ecology, if you will, of all influences that are bearing on this person, and to convey the all-important feeling that things never had to go the way they went, that events, life, the course of history is never on a track. It could have gone off in a very different direction at any point, any time, all the way along.
A fair amount has been written about the relationship between FDR and Churchill, but what about Truman and Churchill? There's a point, and I think it's the Potsdam Conference, where he's saying he can deal with Stalin, but Churchill's another matter. He doesn't want to sit around listening to his long speeches all the time.
Well, he saw, as many did, that Churchill seemed to be a different man than he had been during the war, that he was tired, that he was aging, his vitality seemed down. And Churchill talked an awful lot, and Truman lost patience with that in meetings. They became extremely close as the presidency went on, and at the end of Truman's presidency, on a memorable occasion as they were on the, going down the Potomac on the presidential yacht, having a conference with some of Churchill's staff and some of Truman's staff. Churchill by then was back in office as prime minister. Churchill, when the lunch and dinner plates had been cleared away, put his hands on the table and he looked across at Truman and he said, the last time you and I addressed each other across a conference table, sir, I resented your taking the place of Franklin Roosevelt. But I wanted to tell you now, sir, that you, more than any other man, have saved Western civilization. And he really meant that, because he saw Truman as the one who stood firm, who created NATO, who created the Marshall Plan, and that those two acts alone had saved Europe, had saved Western civilization. I think he was, in many ways, exactly the kind of president the Founding Fathers had in mind, in that he came from the people, and he knew he would return to the people.
America's favorite historian, David McCullough, died Sunday at the age of 89. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Dr. Jim Withers has been making house calls to Pittsburgh's homeless for 30 years, delivering health care and meeting other needs. Thanks to our team, Nick Konopka, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.